gather up. In sports, number one seeds Duke, Virginia, and North Carolina have played themselves into the Sweet 16 in the NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament. In the NBA yesterday, the Bucks beat the Cavs 127-105. In the NHL, the Blackhawks over Colorado 2-1. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Starting out below normal, but by toward the end of the week, we should be above normal in the high temperature department. Details, sunny skies today, a high of 39. The normal for this time of year is 46. It'll feel even chillier, what with northeast winds around 15 miles per hour. Clear skies tonight, a low of 22. Tomorrow, sunshine. The warm-up begins, a high of 42. Expanded forecast for Wednesday through Friday. Generally dry Wednesday and Thursday. A pretty good chance for rain on Friday. Warmer through the period, at least for Wednesday and Thursday. Highs in the upper 50s in Wednesday and Thursday. Much cooler Friday with a high around 43. Right now, sunshine and 32. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Have a feeling that at least some of you recognize that music. It's Hedwig's theme, and it is a theme that recurs again and again in the films of Harry Potter. Harry Potter is the topic of part one of today's morning show. We're going to be talking about the legacy of J.K. Rowling and the Harry Potter books and films because of a big event that is coming up at the Kenosha Public Museum this coming weekend, a two-day or two-night celebration of the legacy of Harry Potter. The event used to be called Potterpalooza, and now it's called Wizardpalooza. And it is one of the, or maybe the major fundraiser of the Kenosha Public Museum. Joining us today, first of all, is the boss, the executive director of the Kenosha Public Museum, Dan Joyce, and with him, two members of the board of the Friends of the Museum, Miles Hartley, who I believe is the president, and Vicki Steger, who is the secretary for the Friends of the of the Kenosha Public Museum, and they also happen to be fervent Harry Potter fans.
That's right.
So we're going to be talking a little bit about why they enjoy this legacy so very, very much. And, of course, we'll be talking quite a lot about what happens at Wizardpalooza. And Dan Joyce knows nothing about Harry Potter, he tells me.
Absolutely nothing. But my children and wife do, so right. It's good.
There you go. But Dan, of course, knows a whole lot about the Kenosha Public Museum. So we're going to kind of find out a little bit from him about how the place functions and why fundraisers like Wizardpalooza are very important to the museum's well-being and ongoing function. So Dan Joyce, Miles Hartley, Vicki Stayer, we welcome all three of you to
thank
the morning
you.
Show.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
Glad you can be here. Vicki, come in just a little closer when it's time to talk, but great to have all of you here. So this began 3 years ago, and I'm suspecting, Dan Joyce, that this wasn't your idea if you are so blissfully ignorant on all matters related to Harry Potter.
I'm blissfully ignorant about many things, and this is just one of them. This is all the fault of Vicki and Miles.
We'll take the blame.
It was a wonderful idea. We're always looking for new fundraisers of various sorts. The Friends were established in 1964 as a support organization, a membership organization and fundraising organization for the museums. And we've had a great membership for decades now, and a great board support, of course. They are a separate 501c3 from the museum. And part of their job is raising some money for us. We have to raise about one-third of our budget every year, and the Friends are an integral part of that. So this is something that came up. One of the big things we did for many, many years, and we're taking a break this year, is our art fair. We did 59 years in a row, and we're taking a break this year. It's 59, right?
I always get it wrong, but I'll go with 59.
Okay,
so good
I think it's 59,
right.
Yeah. But anyways, this would have been our 60th, and we're taking a break this year because of the success of our Wizardpalooza over the last couple of years. It's kind of replacing that in some way. So fundraisers are really important to the museum, and they are vital for our existence.
Very good. I'm just curious, when this conversation first occurred, I assume 3 years ago, about the possibility of this being a fundraiser, do you remember, Dan, any conversation about the fact that museums, at least by and large, deal in facts? And I think we're talking, at least
you're
for the most part, about
facts.
Right, right.
This is heresy.
Who's to say,
mind.
Please?
That's funny.
Well, you know, we also deal in fun, and we also deal in entertainment. And I could make a long argument of how the books are an art that the movies are based on, as well as the movies themselves. So there's a bit of art in here as well.
Sure.
Even though there's not a lot of fact, so to speak.
Right. Well, great, great.
Well, there was also a lot of excitement with the staff, too. A lot of the staff are fans of the books and the movies, and so it was kind of a natural tie-in, too, with and there was some ties in just in terms of the natural history and kind of, you know, having those two things work together. So,
yeah. Well, and of course, this couldn't possibly be a success if you really didn't have the folks at the museum as enthusiastic about as you are.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
I would love to hear from each of you a little bit about your own love affair with all matters related to Harry Potter and how all of that began. And I think, Miles, you were saying that you were kind of a latecomer, so I want to hear that story second.
Sure.
Let's start with Vicki, who I think has been quite a fan for quite some time.
Well, since the books came out, our youngest daughter was a freshman in high school, and their English class read the book, the first book. And so my husband and I read the book, and then the next one came out, and we were those people who stood in line at midnight at Barnes & Noble to get the book when it came out and read it all night and all that kind of thing. And we were always the first ones to make it to the movies and so on, which are just beautifully done. You don't have to be a kid to like them. I mean, we have people all different ages that love them. So it was kind of a natural thing. We even had a Harry Potter shower for our daughter, baby shower for our daughter, and turned our barn into Hogwarts. So a lot of the props and things we had left over.
That
we'll use.
Bank. Right. I'm just curious, were you always reading the books that your daughter was reading for school, or was there something about this first Harry Potter book that inspired you and your husband to actually do that? Or was that kind of a regular thing in your household.
Actually, that's kind of interesting because when my daughter went to Carthage and she was reading some of the books, not those books, but and I read what she was reading just because I hadn't read them before, a lot of the things. So, yeah, we just kind of followed along.
Very good. So do you have a favorite among the books? There are seven in all.
No, because they're all one story.
Mm. So you think of them as one.
I do think of them as one story.
As one big whole. Very good. So, Miles Hartley, as I intimated earlier, you actually, at least compared to Vicki, are a little bit more of a newcomer to
Right. I was a little bit late to the party. So I think when the books originally came out and that kind of that wave that hit everyone, I was a little bit older. So I was in college, I want to say, when the first book came out. And so I kind of missed that. I wasn't kind of growing up with them. And I was also absolutely dead set on my love for the Lord of the Rings series. And so I kind of felt like I would be cheating on Gandalf if I turned to Dumbledore. And so I was kind of dead set against, I refused to let myself, you know, enjoy them. I really didn't watch the movies. And then finally I got to a point where I was like, you know what, I'm going to give them a shot and I'm going to read the books. And I think I ripped through all seven in about 2 weeks and just absolutely loved them. Like Vicki said, it was just kind of one story that you just get so engrossed in with the characters and just the setting of the books, everything about it, and just absolutely loved it. And so for me, it's neat now because I've got children who are getting a little bit older, and so I can enjoy those books with my kids now. And so even though I kind of get, you know, missed that first wave, I read the first two books with my son. We read it out loud, you know, and I read to him at night and just absolutely loved them. So it was definitely a latecomer to the party, but I've made up some ground on the original people that kind of got caught by that first wave.
Right. And I assume you've seen all the films?
Seen all the films. Yep. Went out and bought the collection. And so, yeah, love it. I love it.
So for each of you, what would you say is what draws you so fervently to the Harry Potter books and films? I mean, what is it about them that has you so enraptured?
Don't you think there's something universal about them, about the story? She's a great storyteller.
Right.
She hasn't won all those awards for nothing and made other people who have been writing for years jealous. and she has a way of, when you think a story's going one way, it's really not. And you find that out in the first book. When you're used to, you know, following along a path, you're probably not going there. She has some great twists and turns in there that just are and her characters and her just the way she paints a story, you can see it.
Well, and the world she's created is so lived in. I mean, it's so authentic. And every detail is just, it just feels real. And you can't help but get caught up in the books when you're reading them. They're just amazing.
They are.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking Harry Potter today with Miles Hartley and Vicki Steger, who are both on the board of directors of the Friends of the Museum, the Kenosha Public Museum. And this coming weekend, Friday night and Saturday night,
correct,
is their third annual Wizard Palooza, which is a major fundraiser for the Kenosha Public Museum. And all kinds of different things are going to be offered up. We should mention that, and it's one of the things I love about this event, is that the first night is designed really with children in mind.
For families.
Like the whole
That's
family,
the family. But,
yes, right. That, unfortunately, is sold out.
It is.
Fortunately for the museum, unfortunately for anybody who might be listening to this and would be interested in attending, Friday night is sold out, but there still are a few tickets available for Saturday night's event, which is designed for adults. I'm just curious, is it that different things, dramatically different things, happen at each of those events, or is it just more that they are in intended for kind of a different group of people to attend? Because obviously there'll be a very different atmosphere at the place if it's all adults versus lots of young children running around.
I think there's some differences. And first off, I do want to say thank you to our sponsors, Horizon Construction and Dickow CZAC, that without the sponsorships, we would not be able to put these events on. And so they've been great and a big help and big supporters for us. But there are some differences, and I think primarily in the classes. And so we've got four classes for the adult event and three classes for the kids event. And so the teachers kind of tailor, obviously, the message and the lesson for the different groups. And right. So it's a little bit more tailored for kids and a little bit more interactive, I think, on I shouldn't say interactive, but hands-on maybe to some degree. Mm-hmm. For the kids' night, for the adults, it's a little bit more adult.
And there's alcohol.
Right, and there is alcohol at the adult event, too. Okay. So, and so that makes it more fun. But at both events are just – it's great. It's a great way to show off the museums, too. The Care of Magical Creatures class is going to be held in the new exhibit From Curiosity to Science and kind of use that as a backdrop. And so it's a great way to incorporate the museums into the night. And like I said, I mean, show off these, you know, this beautiful building that the museum has and get to show off all the work of Dan and the staff and what they've done at the museum just to make it that's also a magical place. We talk about a magical place being, you know, the world of Harry Potter. But I for me personally, and I think Vicki would probably echo these sentiments, that for Kenosha, I think the museums are a magical place in terms of what's offered, the classes, you know, the art that comes through. It just, it really is just a great place for Kenosha to have. And three of them. There's three of them. So.
Right. Incredible.
Yep.
So I think if people haven't figured it out already from the fact that one of the classes is a Care of Magical Creatures, we're not talking about standard classes that might be offered at the Kenosha Public right. Museum, but classes very much anchored in the legacy of Harry Potter. Classes taught very much as though they would have been taught at Hogwarts. So
by the professors.
Right. So Vicki, tell us the lineup of classes.
Well, we have divination, and we have Professor Perry, who comes from England, to do those. We have Jen, who is one of our curators of education. She will be doing herbology, I believe. And then potions will be done by her husband, Keith. And we have Care of Magical Creatures will be done by Nick Nurwursum, who is our curator of the Dinosaur Museum. And it's going to be fun. We have vendors there that sell only Harry Potter things. Mm. And we also have an event on Saturday for those who don't have tickets for either event. From 1 to 4 at the Kenosha Public Museum, we'll have the Great Hall opened up, and we'll have the vendors in there. We'll be selling butter beer, and we'll be selling food and things in there from 1 to 4.
Right. If you've never had butter beer, it's worth coming down to try.
It is.
Just for that.
It is authentic, and it is very good.
And I know that you also have crafts and games planned, and also those are planned very much around the themes of Harry Potter.
Absolutely.
We have Quidditch, and we have, what else do we have?
I think we've got kind of a variation on the bags game that's got some Harry Potter ties to it. We've got a lot of crafts, especially at the kids' night, to work with Aragog, the spider activities, and some light switch plates for the adults. So it's just again, it's we just try to make it as immersive an experience as possible. And so even down to the crafts, the classes, the vendors, just everything about the night. Mm. We try to make it as immersive as possible.
There's plenty to do.
Right.
I mean, you'll have that 2.5-3 hours full.
Right.
Right.
I know that one of the means of making money for this, and this is, again, the major fundraiser of the museum, in addition to just the ticket prices, of course, and what people purchase for concessions and so on, you also raffle off some very good prizes.
We have some great prizes,
including
this
a grand
year.
Prize that you should tell our listeners about.
Well, we have a grand prize that is a Hogwarts Lego set of the Hogwarts Castle, which is more than 6,000 pieces.
Right.
We have a display of it set up in the lobby of the Kenosha Public Museum right now. The one we're raffling off is in the set, brand new in the box. It's not, it hasn't been put together, so that somebody will have to put together themselves.
Well, that would be really hard to get home if it was already assembled. So
yes, it would.
That it's a kit.
Handle with care.
Yes, it would. But that is an amazing set. That was donated by one of our board members, and there's one donated for each night. And the only way you can get one or is, you know, to be in the raffle is to be at the event. And the adult one is the only one that's not sold out so far. We also have a handmade Nimbus 2000 that we will be raffling off both nights also. But the Hogwarts Lego set is really amazing.
Yeah.
It has all the little people and all the professors and all Hagrid's castle and our castle little hut. And
wow. So is this something that people tend to show up for in costume?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, oh, a lot of people do, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And each night we do a costume contest as well. And so we kind of do it for the kids. We do a parade of all the kids' costumes. But, you know, I think Vicki had touched on it just on you don't have to be a kid to enjoy these books. And I think that's very apparent at the adult night, is that a lot of people do come in costume. And so this is something that it really does span all ages. And, you know, the adults get into it just as much as the kids. And so there'll be witchers. There'll be witches and wizards and Hagrids and Harrys and Hermiones and
Professor McGonagall,
right,
will have
absolutely.
Her.
So, yeah, so a lot of people do, you know, show up in costume. And it's fun. And people love it. They just have a great time.
Yeah, I find the intergenerational appeal to be pretty amazing and pretty fanatical, which in a good way.
Yeah, right.
We're all crossing our fingers that we can talk Dan into showing up in costume. He's been one of the holdouts so far.
He'd make a good Dumbledore,
right,
don't you think?
Twist his arm a little bit to
there
get,
we go.
Get Dan
so,
in costume.
So when you did the first one 3 years ago, did you do it with any trepidation? I mean, wondering what the response was going to be, and how successful was it right out of the starting
gate? We were shocked, don't you think?
I think we were shocked at the response. Yeah, yes and no. I mean, there is such an audience out there that, you know, it's because it does span all ages, there is an audience. But, yeah, I mean, it was...
It sold out in 48 hours.
It sold out in 48 hours. And the neat thing is we get so many people from outside the community. And so people from other states, you know, people from, you know, Milwaukee, Illinois, you know, Waukegan, whatever it is. But also a lot of people that came up, I think I met some couple that came out from Iowa.
And Missouri.
Right. And so it's a great way to show wow. off, again, the museums and to show off Kenosha as well, too. And so that was, I think that's what kind of took me off guard a little bit, that it wasn't just, you know, people from locally. It was people coming from all over the place.
Who were coming to see what all the fuss was about.
Right, exactly right. Exactly
right.
Very
good. What inspired the two of you to become so active with the museum? Is there something from your own family's experience and encounter with the museum, or were you doing it more out of a sort of a general sense of civic responsibility, which is the reason a lot of people go on boards? What's the story with each of you?
Sure. So I grew up not too far from the museum, back when the only museum in town was at the old dinosaur, which is now the Dinosaur Discovery Museum. And so I took a lot of classes at the museum. I actually have a piece of pottery that I made when I was probably about 7. It's sitting on my windowsill at my office right now. And so the museum was always an important part of my life. In the classes, and I loved my experiences there. So I went to college and then went on to law school and came back and came back to the community and was looking for ways, you know, civic-minded and looking for ways to kind of to get more involved in the community. And this opportunity presented itself actually 9 years ago. It's my 9th year on the board. And for me, it was a no-brainer. The museums were always an important part of my life. And so to get a chance to give back and to help out, that has meant a lot to me. Mm-hmm. And so that's actually my last year as president. I'm finishing off my term. And then after this, I become a life member of the board. And so these last 9 years have been very, very special for me to get a chance to work this closely with, again, Dan and his staff. And it's been fun. So I've loved every minute of it.
Terrific.
And you have another relative who's a life member.
My mother, right. I think she was the one that told me about, hey, there's a spot on the board if you're looking. So yeah, so it's neat. It's neat to have that connection with my mom too is always
good.
Fun. Yeah.
So thanks, Mom.
Yeah. Right, right, exactly. Vicki. Thanks a lot, Mom.
Well, I've been volunteering, I think, for 8 years at the museum since I retired. And it was just kind of one day Mike Dean, who's also on the board, you know, said something about it. And I said, well, how'd you get on there? And he said, well, I'll let you know.
You were volunteering at the museum at the time, which you still do.
I still do, yeah. I still do volunteer there, teach some classes. And, you know, yeah. It's just a great place to hang out, and it's a great facility. I think people in Kenosha, some people in Kenosha don't even know it's there.
Right.
And people from all over the country know it's there and all over the world. I mean, we've had people from Australia last summer, came in New Zealand. I mean, people from all over the place come to see it. And it's worth seeing. It's an amazing place.
Oh, there's all kinds of things there to do. And yeah, very good. Well, it's wonderful that this event has been put together. So, Dan, explain beyond the obvious in terms of You already mentioned the fact that, that the museum needs to raise funds to cover about a third of their budget. And aside from the most obvious, which would be to keep your skilled staff paid and to keep the lights on and the place heated, what else is involved in a place like the Kenosha Public Museum functioning?
Wow.
Monetarily, I mean.
Monetarily. You know, in addition to the Friends of the Museum, like I said, they've been around since 1964 and have been an integral part of the museum in so many ways, including funding. We have a foundation as well, which is another separate 501c3. And they contribute money towards their goal is to build the endowment. We have a certain amount of money that they've been building over the years. And someday, maybe 20, 30 years from now, we may get off the tax roll and still be a part of the city, but, you know, be a little more independent financially that way. But every year they contribute money to us as well. And right now it's $285,000, which, you know, you're talking about the electric and the gas and heat and such. That's about what we spend on gas and electricity for three buildings.
Is that right? Yeah, wow.
That's a lot of money.
So they keep the lights on.
Right.
So, you know, it's becoming more and more difficult every year for nonprofits in general just to keep the lights on. You know, costs go up every year, unfortunately, but that's just a fact of life. And, you know, you need giving to give to increase as well. Every year, and that's always tough as well. So it's always a tough job for people like the Friends and our foundation to keep things going. The museum itself, probably, you know, out of the nearly $1 million that we raise every year, I would say about 70-75% of that is earned income, which we do through charging for classes and bus trips and our gift shops and mm-hmm. things like that, room rentals.
Right.
So that's a fairly steady stream. It's the contributed portion rather than the earned income that's really something you have to work at every year. You have to certainly prove that you're worth giving to.
Right. Well, and I should think that part of what is involved in what you spend your money on is sometimes acquiring things and also taking care of everything that you've acquired, everything that is housed at the museum that needs to be preserved and studied and shared with the community.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because the bulk of our budget goes towards, you know, salaries and benefits and electric bills and, you know, the usual things that people really don't associate with a museum. You know, people go into a museum and they see everything set up and it's like, oh, this is all kind of magical.
And as though the shoemaker's elves.
Right.
Exactly. But it's like any other business in many ways. You have all those constant annual costs that are just there, whether you like it or not. And then in addition, we have costs, like you said, associated with taking care of the collections, putting together exhibits, all of these things that really point towards our mission, or kind of our what I call our mission delivery, is really a small part of the money that we have. Unfortunately, it's a very small part, and we're actually pretty well funded and pretty well supported. But the reality is, most of it goes towards salaries and electric bills.
right. And we should hasten to add, it's a lean operation.
It's very lean.
I mean, yeah. So you are fortunate to have people who are so incredibly dedicated to the museum and to its mission. And
absolutely, we have the most amazing staff. You know, our full time staff is just great. Our part time staff is amazing. We only have 16 full time for the three museums, which is very, very, very lean to run three buildings like that. Right. And do as much as we do, as many programs and exhibits and events of different sorts. So we're very lucky to have dedicated people. And of course, we have a volunteer corps that's, you know, second to none.
Absolutely.
And we have almost 150 volunteers. They do nearly 10,000 hours every year, which is equivalent to about 5.5 full-time staff.
Wow. Terrific. Let's turn back to Miles and Vicki for a brief reminder for our listeners of Wizardpalooza, what's coming up, and how people can still participate if they're interested.
Yeah, so Friday night is the family event. It starts at 5 o'clock. Like you had said earlier, that is sold out. But if people are interested, if families are interested, on Saturday during the day, we'll have the Hogsmeade Marketplace.
From 1 to 4.
From 1 to 4. That's open to the public. There'll be vendors there, chance to purchase butterbeer and popcorn, and they'll get to kind of see some of the decorations. But then Saturday night, we have the Adult Wizard Palooza. That's from 6 to 9. And there are still some tickets available for that. And so if people are interested, I would recommend that they hustle out quick to get those tickets before they're gone.
And how do they get those tickets?
So tickets can be purchased directly from the museum at the front desk. Otherwise, they can go online, and it would be helpful if I recall what the online...
Just search for Kenosha Public Museums.
Through the Kenosha Public Museums, their webpage has a link to purchase tickets directly from that.
Absolutely. Very good.
Yeah, or call on the phone.
Right,
and somebody can help
phone.
You on
yep.
the phone.
And I think it's 653-4140, if
correct.
I remember
correctly.
Yes,
it is.
Yep. I've announced that phone number a whole lot over the years, and happily so. Well, I'm happy that we were able to have this conversation today with Dan Joyce, the Executive Director of the Kenosha Public Museum, Miles Hartley, President of the Friends of the Museum, and Vicki Steger, the Secretary. And I know the two of you are very excited about Wizard Palooza coming up this weekend. Thank you for coming to the morning show to talk about it.
Thank you very much for having us.
Part two coming up in a moment. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part two of today's program. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be revisiting a topic that we broached on Friday's Morning Show with the author of the book called Race and Social Change. But we're going to be talking about issues of diversity and tolerance well beyond the matter of race. And we're going to be speaking with someone who is coming to Carthage College to speak at actually two different events at Carthage. He is Dr. Rahudeep Gill, and he is on the faculty of Cal Lutheran, California Lutheran University, and he is someone who is known across the country for his very interesting ideas and engaging and inspiring thoughts on matters of diversity and inclusion. And his talk that he is going to be giving at Carthage on Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. is titled Beyond Tolerance, Engaging Diverse Worldviews on Your Campus, in which he is, I suspect, going to encourage, challenge us to think beyond the ordinary and the commonplace when it comes to matters of diversity, well beyond the matter of tolerance. He is the 2019 Interfaith Speaker for the Center for Faith and Spirituality. It is under their auspices that he comes to Carthage. Dr. Rahudeep Gill, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be on here. I'm really looking forward to meeting folks out there in Wisconsin.
So tell me, at what point in your life did matters of diversity and inclusion become so important to you? And at what point, in a sense, did you make that really the heart and soul of your professional life and work?
Well, I mean, I think there were several points in my life. You know, as a kid growing up in suburban Boston, alongside kids who were raised by parents and grandparents who had fled the inner city for the suburbs in that phenomenon we call white flight. And then my parents, you know, my immigrant Indian parents chased them into the suburbs, and they didn't know, you know, all the things that were going on under the radar racially in the United States. And so I think I grew up with a certain amount of, you know, bias and prejudice towards somebody of a darker complexion, somebody who's overtly religiously different. I wore a turban from a young age. I think those experiences as a kid opened my eyes to the fact that not everyone's ready for me. Not everyone's ready for people who are different. And when I was in college at the University of Rochester, I'm an East Coaster, although I live in Los Angeles today, I made it my mission to study my own tradition, my own religious tradition, the Sikh tradition. And from then, I was encouraged by my professors to pursue work in a doctoral program at UC Santa Barbara. I got my PhD from there. And then when I was at Cal Lutheran University, I realized that the academy, the higher ed academy, wasn't as diverse and open and pluralistic as I assumed it was going to be. So I like to say sometimes that I was radicalized in the academy itself. So last 10 years, while I've been working here at Cal Lutheran, I've become more and more interested in issues, contemporary issues, even though I'm a historian by trade. I've been much more interested in contemporary issues of diversity and inclusion because of what I see on the campus and because of what my students come to me needing and what I think I can provide them. So it's really a question of vocation for me, which is a deeply important Lutheran concept that I teach and I constantly learn from. So I'm really excited to come out to Carthage, another great ELCA institution, and spread my ideas.
So you are going to be talking Wednesday very specifically about how this plays out on college campuses, but I assume that you've given a great deal of thought to the significance of diversity and inclusion when it comes to other arenas of modern life that have nothing at least directly to do with higher education. How would you compare the way this plays out on at least the typical college campus, the way it compared to the way it plays out, for instance, in various civic organizations or places of business and so on? Are there particular challenges or issues that are part of this when we're talking specifically about a college campus?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I'd like to clarify is that, you know, college campuses are not themselves monolithic, right? So a place like Carthage is probably really different than, you know, University of Wisconsin system. Within the University of Wisconsin system, there's a bunch of different types of colleges and universities, right? Madison is totally different than La Crosse. So I think it really depends on where you are in the system. I think it really depends where you are in the country. And so some colleges are very much like the areas around them. Some people say that colleges are sort of little inclusive bubbles in sort of rural America or suburban America. But, you know, you find surprising things in colleges, universities that are elite and urban and supposedly cosmopolitan. I think the colleges and universities have a particular challenge because they are themselves rooted in certain kinds of oppression, right? Think of how many colleges and universities were built on the backs of slaves or that included, you know, slave ownership. So, for example, recently Georgetown in the D.C. area has had a whole sort of reckoning with its past and its history. And then, you know, folks like women, Jews, they've been excluded from elite college and university campuses for the vast majority of the time that they've existed. So it's only in the last few decades, right, that we see colleges and universities as places that are open to people who are not Christian white men. So a lot of colleges and universities are going through the growing pains of coming to terms with those issues, just like the civic space, just like the business space. So on the one hand, it seems like colleges and universities are these sort of radical places of inclusion and maybe a little bit too liberal for folks. That's definitely there. You know, there's some truth to that. At the same time, if you're an individual on a college and university campus from a community that hasn't been represented on that campus before, you can feel really alienated at a United States college and university.
Hmm. How do you think this issue has been most often misunderstood? And I am assuming that there has been a whole lot of misunderstanding about what is most important with issues of diversity and inclusion. I think if we weren't misunderstanding this, there would be no reason for you to crisscross the country talking about it. So what would be some of those common misconceptions or misunderstandings that, in a sense, hold us back from being as richly and wisely inclusive as we should be?
That's a great question. I think one of the most important challenges that we face is this idea of a zero-sum game, right? That there's, let's say, a pie, and, you know, the majority of people own a certain part of the pie, and now these minorities are coming in, now these women are coming in, these lesbians want a piece of the pie, and there's less for the rest of us to eat. It's not a zero-sum game. Life is not a zero-sum game, right? Life is about sharing. Life is about abundance, right? I'm a religious person. I believe that the universe, the source of the universe, who you may call God or the spirit or the goddess, I think that creator has embedded abundance into the universe. And I think the more we think about these things spiritually or even humanistically, we see that there isn't one pie. In fact, there's a kitchen and there's an abundant supply of raw materials for us to build new kinds of desserts. So in other words, the more inclusive we are, the more new possibilities open up for new kinds of industries, new ways of thought. The more people who themselves might be part of the majority but not rich, part of the majority but not totally, right, you're represented, the more there is for all of us to enjoy. Life is not a zero-sum game. Diversity work is not a zero-sum game. It's about bringing voices to the table. It's about hearing those voices out and really making the best state, city, nation, world that we can together, all 7 billion of us.
As you go around to college campuses, are you focused more on diversity among the student body or diversity among the faculty and staff, or both? Are those really, in your mind, equal concerns and equally cause for concern?
Absolutely, they have to be, because one of the things that, you know, colleges and universities do is they say, well, we want a more diverse student body so we can put, you know, pictures of, you know, black kids and brown kids and women and queer kids in our glossies, right? But once you bring those kids to campus and you don't provide them with the assets and the tools to thrive, you don't provide them with people who are able to understand their diverse experiences, you're setting them up to fail, and you're setting your own college or university up to not be as great as it is. So, but, you know, just bringing those people on campus is just one part of it, right? That's called diversity. It's just a statistic. It's just a description of, we have this many type of this person, we have this many type of that person. Really what we need to be doing is changing the structures so that voices can be heard, and we have to be really hungry to hear diverse perspectives while at the same time training each other on how to express diverse perspectives in an ever diversifying, ever pluralizing United States landscape.
How would you suggest that we talk about this when the topic is broached? Because I think a lot of people feel some reluctance to even venture into some of these topics for fear of framing something in a way that might be either inadvertently offensive, or maybe might sound foolish to somebody, or how would you have us talk about this? I don't mean in situations like you and I talking right now, but I mean in our everyday lives.
I think in our everyday lives, it's important that we set up safe contexts for these discussions to happen. And by safe, I mean, you know, if we really want to get down and dirty into, you know, talking about some things that are really tough, you're going to have to allow people to say things that are going to be offensive. But everyone's going to have to agree on what the boundaries of any conversation are. And the reason that you want to have safe context is you want people to be able to feel brave enough to say things and to ask questions that they might normally not ask. So I think I have an article about safe spaces, brave spaces, and resilient places. So safety is one thing, allowing people to feel brave enough to make mistakes is another thing. And then in the long term, we have to cultivate our own individual, but also our collective resilience for having difficult discourses, for having difficult dialogue. These things are going to hurt. We shouldn't fear the pain of them hurting. We shouldn't be upset that we upset somebody, right? We should expect that walking into these conversations, they're going to be tough. And that's why we have to do them. You see what I'm saying? We also want, at some level, some sense of care for each other. We want to be able to express some sense of sensitivity and some sense of, hey, I might not get this right, but is it okay if I say this, right? Some sense of our own boundaries and politeness that allow us to have civil and civic discourse. And a lot of it, the more of this that we do, the better at it that we'll get. The more that we shy away from these things, the worse at it that we'll get.
So what is the benefit when, for instance, a college or a university or a company or a civic organization is more diverse? For someone who is a skeptic, who wonders why all of this is worth the fuss, the trouble, in what way is an organization or company or school better by being more diverse?
Well, let me say something controversial. I side with the skeptics. The data show that diversity actually decreases trust in organizations. Diversity in and of itself decreases trust and interactions in neighborhoods. So diversity in and of itself is not the goal. Engagement of diversity, inclusion of voices, right? What we call pluralism, the active engagement of diverse perspectives, according to Harvard scholar Diana Eck, is what we need racially, ethnically, in terms of gender, and in terms of religion, faith, and matters of worldview. What the payoff is when we engage diversity, in order to engage diversity, you've got to have it, right? But what we get when we engage diversity is a new sense of our own selves. This is something that's deeply, deeply embedded in our own humanistic history. Although, you know, some of our brains, like our brains function to, you know, understand ourselves in terms of who others are. And so at first, we might be skittish about learning about others, learning about people who are not like us, who are, have not been raised to look like us, to act like us, to eat, sleep, pray like us. But what we learn about ourselves and our own traditions and our own heritage in reflecting on engagement across lines of difference is that we become more fully human ourselves, right? We become more able to deal with the challenges of life. Now, if you're a company, this is the argument that I make for interfaith cooperation at colleges and universities. We say that we want to, you know, educate leaders for a global society. Well, if in the United States you have 80% of people who come from Christian or Christian-ish households, right? If you're working at a global level, that number is now going to drop to 30% of people coming from Christian households. That other 70% are going to be Muslim, Buddhist, atheist, communist, socialist. They're going to have mixed religious identities. Don't you want your company or civic organization or your own children to be able to converse with people who are deeply, deeply different than them, but actually not that different because at the same time we share 99% of the same DNA across all these lines of difference? So I think there's a couple different arguments. You know, you can make the cost-benefit ratio argument, and I think that's a good one to make, but what the argument that I make is that we are only more fully human when we engage across lines of difference. Being in our little bubble, being in our little corner of the world, it gets boring.
Dr. Rahuldeep Gill is going to be speaking at Carthage College, including a public address, 7 p.m., at Siebert Chapel. That's 7 p.m. Wednesday night. His talk is titled Beyond Tolerance, engaging diverse worldviews on your campus. And he's also going to be part of a special interfaith luncheon on Thursday. Dr. Rahul Deep Gill, I really appreciate you making time in your schedule for this conversation. Thank you so much. Safe travels to Carthage.
Thank you. I look forward to being there. I look forward to seeing all your listeners out at the talk.
Tomorrow, Tuesday, on the morning show, we're going to be previewing for you the Lakeside Piano Festival at Carthage College with Dr. Wael Farouk, head of piano studies there. And Herschel Kruger will talk about